From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the September 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Veterans Reunion, Part 1. Every year, close to the anniversary of GCNCS's staff first arriving at Bletchley Park in 1939, we invite our veterans and their families back to celebrate their vital war work. It's our favourite day of the year at the museum, and it allows us to share their amazing stories with our listeners. This year also coincides with the 80th anniversary of the formation of the Auxiliary Territorial Service, or ATS, the women's branch of the British Army during World War II. To celebrate this, our veterans were given a sneak peek at our new ATS pop-up exhibition. In this episode, we'll take you to this year's reunion and listen in as Betty Webb and Mary Watkins reminisce about their time in the ATS, the gas masks, the knickers, and how it changed both their lives. Also, we'll hear from Doris Moss, who arrived at Bletchley in 1942 after escaping the German advance in Belgium 2 years earlier. She then went on to break both Italian and Japanese codes. And finally, actress and drama teacher Elizabeth Davis tells us how she was plucked from Balliol College, Oxford, to help crack Japanese naval codes.
Okay, can I have everyone's attention, please? You all need to look in here, bizarrely. Right, here we go. Can everyone look towards me, please? Oh, hang on, let's have a look. Oh, it's a good one. Hang on, let's do that again. Very nice. And for all time's sake, let's do one more, and then we're done. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.
Can I just say something before everyone moves? Obviously, this is a very, very important day for us. We are so proud to have all our veterans back with us today and from the outstation. Before they move, can I just ask, can we have 3 cheers, please? Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Now you can clap. Hooray!
I'm Erica Munro, and I'm the exhibitions manager.
So down here at one end of the marquee, you're stationed with a display. Now, can you tell me a little bit about this?
On this table is a series of graphic panels. It's a very small display, but I like to think perfectly formed. We've got this display for our veterans as a bit of a preview to a pop-up exhibition that opens on the 6th of September here at Bletchley Park. It's about the ATS, and it's just in time for the 80th anniversary of the ATS being founded. This small display is 3 panels with a bit about what the ATS did in general and about, more specifically, their roles, their jobs and the numbers of them at Bletchley Park during the war. We also look a little bit about the wider role of the ATS in signals intelligence, because while around 400 that we know of ATS personnel worked at Bletchley Park, many, many thousands more were working around the country and around the world in Y stations, sending intercepted messages to Bletchley Park for decryption.
When you think of the ladies who served at Bletchley Park, quite often people automatically think of the Wrens because they were running the bomb machines, but there were WAFs, whose anniversary is next year, and also ATS girls.
Definitely, and actually this display is part of our series of pop-up displays honouring those ladies who worked in those various services. So last year we had a Wrens display. This year we're looking specifically at the ATS, and the display will be located in the garages where most of the ATS personnel would walk past that every day to come into work. And then next year we'll be looking at the WAF.
I mean, people might say, oh, why the garages? But a lot of ATS ladies were actually drivers, weren't they? So the Queen was an ATS driver.
Yes, ATS drivers were not uncommon during the war. However, one thing we've discovered is they weren't very common at Bletchley Park. A lot of the ATS roles were more working with machines and working in the decoding.
Yeah, they got special duty here, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And at the peak of the war, around 400 ATS personnel were here, which in numbers terms is a lot fewer than the Wrens that were here. And I think why sometimes ATS is brought up less. There are far more testimonies of Wrens that served here. But I think just as valid is for us to be able to talk about as wide a number of stories as we can. And it's been great to feature and really focus the ladies of the ATS.
So we're hoping to have 90 veterans here today. And I've been through the list looking for a bunch of ATS girls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they won't mind me calling them girls. And I've only found 9 on that list. So that's like 10%.
We don't have a huge number of ATS veterans on the Roll of Honour. What we've discovered, actually, is that whilst the documentation that survives from Bletchley Park says that 400 ATS personnel at its peak worked here, we know that there were at Forest Moor, at Bow Manor, hundreds, thousands of ATS personnel working there. And we simply don't have a number that we can say as to how many there were. What we do know is that we don't have records of them. So certainly if there are ATS personnel that people know about that worked in signals intelligence specifically that aren't on the Roll of Honour, then yes, we're keen to find out about them.
When we used to meet in the 1990s, lots of us would go in there. But mark you, it's partly age where they, you know, may have passed on. And it was such a friendly thing. It was my, I told you, my university. So it was that sort of atmosphere.
Yes.
If you ever met them afterwards, you thought, this is like my university. I went to college after I came out of the forces, but the army training and being with the others, I considered more my university.
I quite agree with you, Mary. Mm. I've always considered this to be my university because I never aspired to anything more than that.
No, I didn't really aspire, but because of Bletchley Park, I got the chance. I would never have got the chance without I'd been here.
That
was my, not inspiration, but my chance.
Yes.
Because after the war, I had no difficulty at all in getting good jobs. Whereas before the war, hadn't a chance. I was exploited before the war.
It's interesting that you say that because I found it quite difficult being interviewed by prospective employers after the war when I had to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you I've been doing. Because then they sort of closed up. And
but they were intrigued. When I went for a job at Fulham Borough Council, for instance, when he said, what did you do during the war? And I said, well, I'm afraid I can't tell you. But it was all clerical. All would be useful with what you're asking for me. And then immediately they gave me an IQ test, which we didn't know much about IQ tests then. When I passed, he said, when did you get your degree? I said, I haven't a degree. So he said, well, I suggest you get something on paper as soon as you can. And that's why I trained to be a teacher.
Oh,
I thought I had something on paper.
Yes, well, I'm sure that was necessary because I went to secretarial college.
That was the thing to be when we
were young. Yes, courtesy of the government. I didn't have to pay for it, fortunately.
You didn't?
No, I didn't. It was in London. It was fairly extensive in that terrible winter of 1947.
Yes,
but no, I think the fact that we were here was a good stepping stone, wasn't it?
Oh, well, it was in actual fact, even though you didn't say that you were at Bletchley Park.
No, that's right. Oh,
the very fact, well, it must be that it made us brighter being here. That's what I like to think.
Absolutely. Well, I think being here was an education in itself.
Exactly. So that you're not so diffident when they ask questions because you felt you could cope with it.
That's right. But the fact that there was such a cross-section of the community here...
That's what life.
Yes. I mean, I met people here that I would never have met otherwise.
No. And same for me.
Yes. Stood me in very good stead. Mm. No doubt about that.
We've just been listening in on two lovely ladies who both served in the ATS. Now, could you both just introduce yourselves for me?
Yes, well, my name is Betty Webb, which was Betty Vine-Stevens when I was actually employed at Bletchley, and I was in the ATS, but that didn't mean very much because once here, you were just assigned to a department, and the fact that you were in a service didn't really mean very much. We just jogged along with the rest of our colleagues, whether or not they'd been in the ATS or the RAF.
I'm Mary Watkins, and I was at Bletchley Park during the war, and I worked mainly with other civilians. I was in the ATS, but the people I worked with were called computers in those days, in the way that typists used to be called typewriters. Mm. And that's how they did it with the computers. And I worked with these civilians. And I worked with the same group more or less all the time I was here. We worked in London, Caxton Street, to start with. And bit by bit, the contingent was moved as a whole body, first to Leicestershire, an outpost there. What was it called?
Bow Manor.
Was that Bow Manor?
Bow Manor Park. And that was the loveliest part of my career because it was like having a good clerical job and being looked after by orderlies.
It's a holiday.
Now you can imagine what fun that was to go and be taken care of. Then we were moved here. Here was not so pleasant because of the shifts.
Oh,
I had
yes.
to work 9 till 8, 8 till 4. Four to midnight,
yes.
And the body cannot put up with that.
No.
You had a day off at the end of the week.
If you were lucky.
Exactly the same work, but you were at little pokey huts, and you never know if it's a hut for four people or for several, but you couldn't intermingle, not even with the other people.
Oh, no, absolutely
that
not.
That was really so hard to be, you know, to find it like that. But the best part of my life was my service career.
Yes.
We've got an anniversary coming up for the ATS.
Yes.
Now, Betty, you're very much behind this, aren't you? What anniversary have we got coming up?
This is the 80th anniversary of the formation of the Auxiliary Territorial Service.
I mean, we find this with anyone who served in any branch, that they're very proud of their branch. But I think especially you ATS girls are very proud of being ATS ladies,
oh,
aren't you?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, because some of us still are. I'm still a member of the WRAC Association, yes. which I brought up at the meeting earlier on. And it's a wonderful thing to be connected with. It was a tremendous camaraderie.
I've always been a club person.
Yes.
So it was, to me, it was ideal to be with other people in the club. I was a guide when I was young, and it was a continuation of the guides to me.
Yes, you know. I can understand that, yes.
Did both of you have similar training? So what was your basic training?
Would you like to fire first?
I moved when I was young from Chelsea, where I was born, to Margate. And quite frankly, I never had a chance to take the scholarship exam.
Right.
And because of that, when I got to my Margate elementary school, they put me 11-year-old with a 14-year-old because... Sounds braggy, but because my ability was to the 14-year-olds, but emotionally, I wasn't a 14-year-old. So it didn't really work. But I made up my mind, knowing that I'd missed my chance, that I would do all I could to do it on my own. So when I left school, I applied to go to night school, and they said, how old are you? When I said 14, they said, you should be at school. Now, I couldn't tell them. My parents had fallen on hard times and I had to go to work. I know I'm making that a bit of a sob story, and I suppose it is in
a way.
Well,
it's your story.
It's my story.
Yes.
And so I waited till I was 16. Then I went to evening class, did all I could after to catch up on the time that I'd missed when I was young. And to be absolutely truthful, I spent the rest of my life trying to catch up what I missed when I was young.
What was your basic training like when you joined up?
Oh, that was very interesting. We did nothing to do with the work here. It was country dancing, lectures, talking about ENSA, the education thing. But we did have to write, why did you join the army? And I did make an impassioned plea about how hard it was for a girl to do anything in early 1940, and how I was so pleased that now something had come along where I could work and I could do something to show my worth. And I think that impassioned essay that I wrote, that's why I think I was chosen.
Oh, well,
truly, I know that sounds a bit odd, but I think that was one. That's the only thing I can think. And of course, when I got in, they asked me things like crosswords, which I always love, quizzes, how soon can I get the telegraph? They asked me all those things. And of course, I could say the right thing. They also asked me something that you didn't do at elementary school. They said, had any languages? I said, well, I've only got schoolgirl French. But they accepted that, schoolgirl French. But I was keen to learn, I must tell you that.
And what about your training, Betty?
My training at the Royal Welsh Fusilier Depot in Wrexham was jolly hard work, physical work. We had to learn how to march, how to wear our uniforms properly, and how to address our superiors. I can't remember the length of it, but at the end of the training, which included gas mask drill, which was hell, because they used to put us into a small room with gas. We wore the, obviously, military gas masks, and in this exercise, we were put into this small room, and the gas masks were to be taken off while they sprayed some gas so that
your
it
reaction
was impressed upon you that you don't disregard a gas warning. And it was horrid, and I think that's why I've still got a funny throat, but that's another story.
I've heard you in the past talking about the uniforms. Now, how bad were they?
When we first had them, they hadn't even a belt round them. They were plain in 40, and then they improved them by giving a belt to it. But the bad thing was, they had stockings the colour of mustard. The most comfortable stockings you've ever had. They were fashion, but the colour was terrible.
Colour was awful, wasn't it? And they were
terrible.
Very thick.
Very thick.
Yes.
And awful. And the more you wash them, the more horrible the colour became.
Too right, yes. But I think the worst part of the uniform issue was the knickers.
Oh,
because
yes.
Because they were so long that you either had
passion crushers,
passion crushers. But you see that they were so big that you either had the top up around your armpits, or if you had round your waist, the rest of it was
ankles.
Down round your knees. Having said that, they were suitable for all weathers, I think, really, weren't they?
They were good quality clothes.
Good quality. A little rough, but good quality.
Is it nice that you can get together here and meet fellow members of the ACS?
Yes, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's another life, really, that we had then. And it's another life which people, you understand, but an awful lot of younger people don't.
No.
They can't envisage
younger
it.
Younger people can't. They talk a different language. The past is a foreign country, and we're the past.
Yes, that's right. Some of them want to know, but the young generally can't envisage how it was.
Well, I suppose it's so alien to them. We do get a lot more people now are fascinated with, you know, World War II in general. And especially the more that the story's told about Bletchley Park through different medium, like The Imitation Game, but all different ways, more interest we get here. And the more we can tell the real story, your stories.
Yes, that's
I think
right.
That's what's important.
My granddaughter is particularly interested. You never bore her with telling her about it.
No, I never get bored listening to you ladies at all.
No, you're marvellous the way you soak it up.
And you two hadn't met before today?
No, I don't think so. No.
I hope we meet next year.
I hope we will, yes. That would be lovely, yes.
Well, ladies, thank you very much, and happy birthday to the ATS.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely, yes. We had a fantastic day at Ulrawas. That was celebrating the 80th anniversary of the ATS. And I was honoured by having to read the warrant of 1938. We had a service, and that was part of it.
Brilliant.
It was brilliant. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for your service.
We'd do it again, wouldn't
we? Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Guy Revel, and I'm the Museum Archivist at Bletchley Park.
Now, Guy, you're in the marquee as well. What have we got here? Because I'll have to describe this for our listeners. but you've got a string of 16 pictures by the looks of it. Now, what are these? Where do they come from and why are they hanging up on the marquee wall?
Well, this is a selection of images from our archive collection where we do not know the identities of the individuals shown within the photographs. So we thought that veterans might be able to help us identify either the individuals or the occasion or the place in which these images were taken.
Because we have this myth that, you know, Bletchley was so secret and no photos were taken apart from a very few official ones towards the end of the war. But that's not true, is it?
Well, most of these photographs are off duty. So none of these are actually on site at Bletchley Park. So they'll all be on downtime. So perhaps in billets, or there's a couple in, we know are in the garden of a pub in Woburn, for example. There were wrens billeted nearby at Woburn Abbey.
There's quite a rakish chap there at the end with a straw boater on.
Yes, I think he's one of the Americans from Little Brick Hill.
Oh, he is, isn't he?
Yes. So Little Brick Hill, also not very far from Woburn. So the Americans there have gone along to Woburn to meet some of the wrens.
Just to swap secrets, no doubt. I came in and saw you a few days ago and you were going through a load of these pictures, weren't you? But why have you specifically picked these ones?
Well, a lot of them are group portraits because we thought that would increase the chances of recognition. Yeah. So we could have 16 images where they're all individuals, but that only gives you 16 chances of someone knowing who they are. The ones where we do have individual portraits, it's because they are really strong portraits. The original image is of a high quality and it will stand up to being enlarged so that it can be seen from a distance, or if it was to be used in an exhibition, for example, we wouldn't want it necessarily at original size.
No. So hopefully, by the end of the day, we might have some of these filled in then.
Well, that's the hope, but it's not the be-all and end-all. It's just a nice opportunity for our veterans and their families to see some of the people that were working at Bletchley and the outstations. Maybe bring back a few memories, reignite some thoughts, and even if nobody gets identified, hopefully some of the veterans will have had some enjoyment from seeing the photographs. And, of course, there's always the opportunity that a relation will come along and see that there's Granny having fun with the Americans in Woburn Pub Garden.
I'm Doris Moss. I worked at Bletchley Park, and Hut 4 and Hut 6, I deciphered messages in Italian and we had translators to do it.
Doris, I've been told that you've got a fascinating story that starts before you even get to Bletchley Park.
Oh, yes, yes, I did. My father married a Belgian girl, lady. He worked in France, so we lived in France till I was 7, and then I went to Belgium because my father went to England in the army during the war, and we had to leave Belgium because of the bombing, and the Germans might have put us in a concentration camp, my sister and I, you see. So we took a train all the way down to the south of France, and on the way down in the train we were bombed by the Germans. That was my mother, my sister and I.
So this was 1940?
1940. Mm. And a dog.
What was the dog's name?
Rita. She was a Cocker Spaniel. We left her in the south of France, actually. Oh. And so we took a train and we were bombed while we were in the train. But they didn't get the station. They came later on in the evening and got the station. Mm. And then they took us out of the train and made us walk to the next station. The Germans came over with their aeroplanes, so we all lay down flat on the ground. And when they'd gone, we left, went up to the next stop, and we went on another train through Spain up to Lisbon, and that's where we stayed. And when we got to Lisbon, a ship left with some of the refugees, but we were not on the list because we came too late. Mm. And that was sunk with all hands on deck.
Oh, good Lord.
So the British government decided to have a big ship. We went in Lisbon for 4 months, and then we went to Gibraltar, and there we waited for a big ship to take us back to England. Mm. And it was a Polish ship, and we got to England after 6 days in a Polish ship. But in the Polish ship, we were told to put our passports and our names and stand by the lifeboats because we were going through a minefield. So, of course, that's another escape. And then we ended up in Southampton. And from Southampton, we went to Shortlands, where my uncle lived. And he knew somebody we wanted to join the Wrens, but we couldn't. So he knew somebody in Admiralty. So we had an interview in Admiralty in 1942 with Mr. Birch, Frank Birch.
Oh, really?
It was Frank Birch, ah. That's right, yeah. And we got to Bletchley Park in Hut 4 and then Hut 6.
So when you got to England, did you just want to do your bit to fight against
the
Germans?
Well, we thought we'd have to do something, didn't we? So we thought the best thing was to try to... And we went to Bletchley Park. That's how we got to Bletchley Park.
Because I suppose, really, more than most of our veterans at Bletchley Park, you'd actually witnessed the Nazis firsthand, hadn't you?
I did, yes.
And that must have given you a real momentum to want to do something.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So did you have any idea... Well, obviously... I know what the answer to this question is going to be. You had no idea what you were going to do when you got here, did you?
Not a clue.
So do you remember those early days? What happened?
Well, we were very, very shy, my sister and I, you know, and so because we didn't speak that good English.
So did your sister start with you here as well?
Yes.
All right.
And we were billeted in the village of Milton Keynes with Captain Grain and his wife, who said, if you can't speak the King's English, don't speak at all.
Oh.
So I learned the grammar from him, opposite to and different from and all that jazz. So I could speak proper English. I still had the accent, of course.
You've got a beautiful accent.
If I try, I might do better, but I can't be bothered to try. I mean,
so tell me where you worked in Bletchley, and do you have any memories of what you actually did?
Yes, I do. Hut 4. Mavis Beatty used to decipher messages on the Enigma machine.
Yes.
And she passed it on to me.
Ah, right.
My sister worked on the haggling machine.
Yes.
Because John Alexander collected the haggling machine, and he's the one who first interviewed us in Bletchley Park.
Right.
You see, he came to my house.
So you had all the important people interviewing you then, didn't you?
Yes, he came to my house.
What was your day-to-day work in Hut 4?
Well, we worked, as you know, we worked shifts. So I just deciphered messages in Italian with these block things, you know, five letters, another five letters, and you move them along, and you get a message.
So
it's all in the book.
So you were hand-breaking these ciphers. You weren't using a machine to break these. You were using your brain.
Well, no, I wasn't using my brain at all. I was not using my brain. Anybody could have done it. I know my sister said we were decoders, but we were not decoders. We deciphered messages. I did decipher. She was on the haggling machine, but I deciphered. Took over from Mavis Beatty.
Well, bearing in mind that Mavis Beatty was one of our code breakers, and if you took over from Mavis Beatty, you were deciphering messages.
I think anybody could have done it.
Well, not everybody did do it, so...
Oh.
So you take that as a compliment,
Doris.
Oh,
well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I know my sister thinks she's done it, but she wasn't even on it. She was on the haggling machine.
And did you do that for the whole time you were here?
Yes, I did. Then I went to the Japanese section.
Oh, really?
When the European War.
Yes.
Then I went to the Japanese section, they wanted me to learn Japanese. I mean, I know the word for Liverpool, which is Ribapur, but that's about all I know. And then we went to London in 1947 to help with the history of the naval war.
Oh, right. So working on the official histories.
Yes, but as proofreaders.
Mm.
Proofreaders. So we worked there till 1947. Then I went back to Bedford, and I worked in a bank there. Then I met my husband, and we went back to live in Northampton because he was promoted within the office. Yeah. Normally, he moved from one place to the other before he married me, you see. He was in Bedford, and then he was promoted to Northampton, and there he stayed.
And where do you live now?
Northampton.
Do you know what? What? So do I.
You don't.
I do. I live in Northampton. So you worked in Hut 4, and then you also worked in Hut 6, was it?
With the Japanese section, yes.
So what are your memories of being here? Do you enjoy being here?
I did. I was never bored. People said they were bored. I was never bored.
Well, you were doing something very special. That's why, I think.
That's probably why, yes. And then, anybody could have done it.
You say that.
I tell you, yes, I do.
You see, in all the years I've been doing this, I've never heard one veteran brag about what they did. You're all so modest. It's amazing. And thank you so much for today.
You're quite welcome.
For this interview. Yeah. And can I just say thank you for your service?
Yeah. All right, then. I must tell my family now. My youngest son came last year with me, and I've got my oldest son as well now, who's a vegan. And so Ian Standen gave him a big plate of vegan food.
Oh, that was nice.
Because I know Ian Standen very well.
Oh, that was nice of them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much,
Doris.
Okay,
you're quite welcome.
Jonathan Byrne, the Oral History Officer at Bletchley Park.
We've come to the end of another very successful Veterans Reunion. And it's always a very busy day for you and your team, isn't it, this day?
Oh, yes, it certainly is. We've had 72 veterans visit us today. We've had a chat with them all. And we've also been very lucky to speak to 17 who are visiting today who we haven't yet had a chance to interview.
Oh, brilliant.
And they've all said, yes, they'd love to be interviewed. And we'll be in contact with them the next few weeks to arrange a date.
Because this is when your hard work starts, isn't it? Because you've then got to arrange yourself or our volunteers. You've got a team of volunteers, haven't you?
That's right. I've got a team of about 20 volunteers altogether who help with the interviews and writing up the recordings. In some ways, this is the busiest time of year because although we're constantly interviewing throughout the year, we're suddenly now landed with 17 to do, hopefully, before the weather gets too cold. And so September and October will be quite busy for us, yeah.
And also, this year, you've started a new project, haven't you, with the oral history as
Yes,
well.
We have. The oral history project has always concentrated on people who worked at Bletchley Park or its numerous outstations worldwide. And we've interviewed now about 450 people like that. But we haven't interviewed many people who lived in the community outside of Bletchley Park and therefore were affected by it. Maybe, for example, their parents may well have had Bletchley Park staff billeted on them. So we want to hear the stories about that, how that happened, how they felt about it. Just an impression of the effect that this secret establishment had on the local community. What did people think about it? Obviously, they didn't ask because there was a war on, but they must have had some ideas, some thoughts and impressions of it. So we'd love to pick all those up, record all those, yeah.
This place must have made a significant change to the community, mustn't it? Because we look now at Bletchley's in the middle of this sprawling metropolis of Milton Keynes. But we go back to World War II. This was just a collection of small villages, wasn't
it? That's right. You had Bletchley, obviously, on the doorstep. And you just look around, you can see most of the housing is very much post-war. So they were a much smaller community to support Bletchley Park. And it wasn't just Bletchley, of course. You had Wolverton, you had other villages around here. And also as far away as Leighton Buzzard and Bedford were affected. But we're particularly interested in people who, to start with, certainly who were in the what is now the Milton Keynes area. Wherever they're living now, we'd love to hear from them.
Well, I interviewed a lady earlier today and she said she was billeted in Milton Keynes Village. That village is so long gone, hasn't it?
That's right, yes. I remember seeing that on a form someone had filled in telling us about their wartime story. And it said, you know, actually said Milton Keynes. I thought, what? And then I realised that they meant the village, yes.
Right, well, I'd better let you go and have a rest now, and then you can start your work Monday morning, getting all these vitally important oral histories recorded.
Yes, it's been a lovely hot day, but hard work, and I'm going to put my feet up now.
Thanks, Jonathan. I have Elizabeth Davis with me. Now, Elizabeth, where did you serve during World War II?
In Hut 7.
And what did Hut 7 do for those listeners who don't know?
It was, I think, all Japanese naval codes. But I can't be sure because we didn't go into anybody else's office.
No.
You just went into your own office and you did what you had to do and you didn't really know what went on anywhere else, which made it less interesting, really, than it should have been. I've met people after the war at reunions and so on, which have explained to me what I was doing.
We interview a lot of Wrens, and today we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of the ATS.
Yeah.
But you're neither of those, are you? You were actually working for the Foreign Office.
I was recruited from Oxford University as a Foreign Office civilian, yes.
So what were you studying at Oxford?
I was studying science subjects, but that didn't seem to be really part of it.
I think they probably just wanted you for your brains, didn't they?
That's about it, I think. Such as they were, yes.
So how did the recruitment come about?
Well, I think that there was a group of people, I've learned this since, in Baillieu College, who were responsible for spotting people that might be useful, but I don't know. I've also read somewhere that they rather liked somebody who'd only done a year and not got stuck into sort of... that they wanted people who were very open-minded.
Oh, right, yeah. Mm. Did you have an interview? Or?
Yes, I do remember a rather cadaverous man, and I think he was at Balliol College, one of somewhere. I really got the impression that I didn't have much option. I mean, I was quite happy. I hadn't really enjoyed my course and had spent most of the time acting and directing plays, so I wasn't too broken-hearted to give that up. We were told that our places would be kept for the end of the war.
So what year was this that you were at Oxford?
1943 to 1944, and then I came to Bletchley.
And what age were you then?
I must have just had my 20th birthday.
Right.
A little bit beyond 20.
So you felt, when you had the interview, that you didn't really have a choice, really? In...
No, I mean, you were called up at 18. I was lucky to have had a year at Oxford.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of my friends didn't get that. They were called up, you know, when they were 18.
Mm.
I was given a remission of a year.
And did you have any idea at all what you were going to be doing, or were you just told to come here?
None. We were told we were Foreign Office civilians, and that's what we were to say to anybody else. Secret work for the Foreign Office, I think, was the sort of formula.
Yeah.
Secret work for the Foreign Office. And then you were given a train ticket, a train warrant, to Bletchley, and you got on the train and arrived at Bletchley.
We hear that from so many veterans.
Yes.
No idea.
No.
Probably didn't even know this place existed.
Oh, no.
And, I just got a railway chit to go to Bletchley.
That's
and that
it.
Was the start of it.
Yes.
Your actual work in Hut 7, did you do any training beforehand, or were you thrown straight in?
Yes, I had a week's indoctrination, as it were, up in the block, the naval block.
Hmm.
Block A, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. I had a week there. I had a very severe interview in the mansion, I think with Mr. de Grey, about secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to sign the Secrets Act. And I also had a month's Japanese course.
Some, in Bedford?
In Bletchley.
Oh.
I can't remember where. I think somewhere in the buildings behind Hut 7.
Ah.
But that was a month. And we had to start in the traditional way with learning our characters, Chinese characters, of course.
Yeah.
And painting our cards with the different characters.
Yes.
And then learning the kana.
We did an episode all about the Japanese school
really?
In Bedford. So all these things that you're telling me, I've been told of by our archivist.
Well, that's...
And you're living proof of it.
Yes. And I think the tutor, he had been, I think, in the embassy in Tokyo.
Hmm.
I don't know if you can identify him. Could his name have been Lloyd? He was also a published poet, I think.
Oh.
So I was told, but I'm not sure.
So when you actually got into the day-to-day work, can you remember what you were doing?
We were working on the JN-40 most of the time, and then occasionally I would be lent to another office in the hut working on the JN-40. 25, which was, I think, the Naval High Command, wasn't
it? Yes, I think so.
That was quite a complicated one, probably similar to some of the German codes.
Mm. Oh, yeah. We found out about the German build-up for D-Day because we read the Japanese embassy's messages back to their homeland, telling us all about the visit they just had to Normandy. What was your physical day-to-day job?
Well, on the usual one, the JN-40, we worked on squared paper, all piled up ready for us, somebody somewhere must have been tearing up those standard school books.
Mm.
Well, you know, they came in lined paper and squared paper.
And grid paper, yeah.
Squared paper. We had piles of these squared papers to work on. I can't remember the details. We must have laid it out in the squares, and they were quite low-grade shipping, quite small ships, and they changed it every week.
Mm.
You had to break them at the beginning of the week, and of course you had to have enough signals come in to work on.
Mm. So you were doing this by hand then?
Yes,
just by hand. You were hand breaking?
Absolutely. Just with a pencil.
That's amazing.
A pencil and a bit of squared paper.
That's remarkable. I mean, there's not many people around now who were hand-breaking scythers.
I suppose not.
That's fantastic. I mean, did you have any idea what you were doing?
Well, we knew that we were breaking signals from ships. What we didn't know, and I only learnt after, by meeting people at the reunions, actually, was that this information was going to the translators, the genuine translators. We only knew enough to recognise words so that we knew when we had broken the code, like submarine, sensui khan. When these words came up, we knew we were there.
Yeah.
But those signals that we interpreted giving positions of ships, positions of sightings of submarines, were all going to a hut, which the Wrens were in charge of. And I met a Chief P.O. Wren at a reunion who was in charge of this map room, and those ships were all being plotted in this map.
Yes.
That would have been terribly interesting to me at the time. I mean, I didn't know who was going to get my signals when I decoded them.
You see, that's funny. It's I suppose you don't think of your job as being important when you're doing it, and you think of the other person, oh, they've got this great big map. That must have been brilliant. But your job was more important because you were giving them the information to put on there.
And then our decoded signal went to the translators, and then they were sent on to strategic people. Positions of ships were plotted on the maps in the map room and probably in the Admiralty in London. The strategic people in Hut 6 decided who needed to know this in the field.
That's
and so some of our decodes were going straight to the field, and the ships that we were able to plot were being sunk as a result.
Mm.
I didn't know that.
No, you wouldn't.
No.
So how long were you here then?
A year.
A year. And were you here right up to the end of the Japanese War?
No. We were allowed to apply for redundancy after the end of the European War.
Oh, really?
Because so many people from the European War wanted to stay on.
Yeah.
And they were probably more experienced codebreakers than we were. And I'd got plans. I wanted to go into the theatre. And so I applied for redundancy and I began writing to theatre schools and theatre companies. And so I went straight from Bletchley into the Donald Wolfitt Shakespeare Company.
Oh.
He was on tour at Nottingham. And I hitched down from Bletchley with all my belongings to Nottingham and joined the Donald Wolfitt Shakespeare Company.
And so did you carry on as an actress?
Yes, until I became a naval wife and had to tour around the world, and also a mother of four children eventually. And so I left the theatre at that point and then retrained as a drama teacher when my children were young, and taught for 10 years. And then you had to retire at 60. And so I went back in the theatre when I was 60.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And you
I've retired last year.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, I've had a long career.
A long and very fulfilled career by sounds of it. Well, it's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you, Elizabeth, and thank you so much. And to meet someone who was doing such a specific job as you were, it's fantastic.
I don't know whether somebody presented me with those codes, whether I could put them out on a bit of squared paper. Now, I've no idea.
Well, I don't think we're going to ask you now.
How we set them out.
No.
Or, you know, it's just gone.
I always find it remarkable. I mean, you know, I can't remember things that I did in a job that I did 10 years ago.
That's it.
I mean, to think back 75 years.
Your brain can probably only hold the things it needs. And you don't need that. It's the same with a play. Mm. If you're playing repertory, which I did in the early days, weekly repertory, you can't hold all the plays in your head. On Saturday night, you wipe it clean.
Because you were doing a different play every week,
yes,
weren't you?
Yes.
If you were a touring company, especially, weren't you?
Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, and I hope you have a lovely day today.
I will, I'm sure. It's a lovely weather for us, isn't it?
Very you deserve
fortunate.
It.
Very fortunate. Nice to have met you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.